to take the family's food, even though he had known he would need it. He drank from streams and hid in caves and holes when it rained. Weeks passed, and he began to find indications that Vali was not moving as quickly. He was stopping regularly, sometimes in caves, sometimes in the open. But there was a different smell to the mess he was leaving now. Beneath the human scent was something else. Feleg knew it better than any smell in the world. It was wolf. After days more travel, the mountains ended, and Feleg was at the edge of a broad plain going down to low hills by the sea. After some scouting, he found a place where the grass was flattened. He followed the trail and saw a mob of ravens ahead of him. They scattered to the sky as he approached, rising like the spirit of the corpse they had been eating. The dead man had been a hunter. His squat bow was nearby. Feleg took it, along with the arrows. He hadn't shot a bow since he was a child, nor used any other weapon, but now he would accept any help he could get. The ravens were watching from a distance.
"You'll eat when I'm done here, and not before," Feleg said.
He knelt to the corpse. The skull was sheared in two. No bird had done that. Half a day's walk yielded another find. He could see something had rested beneath the lee of a rock, and, from the flatness of the grass, that it had been there for some time. Leading away were prints, but they were not Vali's. This was something bigger, still on two legs, but with a huge stride. Feleg sniffed at the footprints, and the same signature came back. Wolf. As he went on, there were other tracks too, reindeer and broad sled marks on the wet grass, obscuring all signs of the prints. The clouds hung black over the land. Great petals of snow began to fall, settling cold upon his skin. With Vali's trail gone, Feleg simply followed what looked like a path towards the sea. How long had he been on the prince's trail? The moon had been full twice, and when it could be seen, was now a silver sliver in the night sky. But it wouldn't be visible that night. The weather was closing in, but there was no prospect of shelter nearby. Over the 2 months, his strength had returned, and Feleg kept up a good pace. Then he spotted the island. It was a long, flat loaf of rock, like a reflection of the clouds, a white tear into the dark fabric of the sea. He had no coat, only the wolf pelt, a pair of ragged trousers the Danes at Hemming's court had given him out of pity, a shirt and a cloak he had taken from the ship. He had something else he could use to protect himself from the cold, but hesitated to do so. He had kept them around his neck since he had taken them from a body on the Danish ship, but hadn't yet had the courage to put them on. It felt like a betrayal of Kveldulf even to carry them. But he saw the sense now. Most of his life he had simply tied pieces of reindeer fur around his feet in the cold. Now he pulled on the pair of boots. They were a little too big, but good enough. He wondered if he should stuff grass inside them to insulate them, as the farmers did. In his mind he heard Bragi's voice.
"Are you going soft on me, son?"
Feleg smiled to himself, the memory keeping him warmer than any of his clothes. He could smell something on the breeze. Reindeer. He stopped and listened. He heard the clicking of their hooves, that distinctive sound reindeer make even on soft grass, and he could tell they were standing. On again, on through the whitening world, running now to keep the cold at bay, hoping to kill a reindeer and crawl inside its carcass for the night, for warmth. In the dying light, he saw movement, and realized that the reindeer were not alone. There were figures of men about them, and the beasts were tied to small, flat, wooden sleds. Feleg slowed to a walk. Across on the island, he could just about see figures making their way to the top. Some sort of assembly was taking place. He came to a small cliff over a short beach of silver shingle. The sea below him looked angry. From across the water, howling and drumming filled his ears. He started to feel very odd, almost as though his limbs weren't his to command. He walked on to where the reindeer were, and saw something like his own reflection. A man beside a sled was wearing a wolf pelt, almost like his own, but white. Another wore a coat of black feathers, and had his hair shorn and spiked to resemble a bird. They ignored him, finished tying the legs of their animals, and made their way down to the beach. He followed them across to the sea, where they began to push a tiny boat out into the heaving water. Felix was acting on impulse now, the howling and the drumming filling his mind. He had to find shelter. The men could find him shelter. Throwing away the hunter's bow and arrows, he ran forward, helped push the boat out into the water, and got in with the two men. They didn't say a word, just helped him aboard for the short but terrifying trip to the island. The boat grounded on a tiny beach beneath a cliff, and they all climbed. The jabber was intense now, and his companions pulled out their own drums to join in as they ascended. At the top, Felix found himself on a plateau. 50 men in animal masks faced him, all drumming, shrieking, barking and roaring. The sight paralyzed him. Then, as if on a command, a sudden silence. The men parted, and a small man in a wolf mask came forward. He was frail and clearly in pain. He approached Felix, gazed into his face, then turned to his brothers and said something in a strange language. The drumming took on renewed life, and hands grasped Felix. Charms and icons were shoved into his face, water thrown on him, and then he was being carried across the island. He fought and tore and knocked men to the ground, but the press of numbers was too great, and he was shoved and manhandled, kicked and clubbed across the island. Ropes were produced and thrown over him. When he shook them off, others replaced them. The drumming seemed to be draining him of strength, and finally, inevitably, he was bound. By this time there was no need. The drums had entered his head, robbing his limbs of movement. They dragged him to a cave, a gaping mouth that seemed to transform the hillside into the jaws of some ugly monster. He was mobbed into the hole by the dancing firelight of lamps, and long shadows reached out like spider legs, as if to inspect him, as he descended the slope into darkness. Then, where the floor fell away, the man in the wolf mask came forward, holding a torch in one hand and a bright iron knife in the other.
"Lord," he said in Norse.
He bowed his head and turned Felix to face the dark. In one movement, he slashed the bonds on his arms and pushed him hard in the back. Felix tried to turn to strike him, but couldn't seem to make his body respond. He dropped into the dark. It was a heavy fall, and he was stunned for a couple of breaths. When he recovered his senses, he could hear someone panting, trying to control themselves, but taking in great gulps of air in panic.
"What are you?"
"Lady," said Felix. There was another cry. He was sure it was Adisla. Even through her sobs, he was certain it was her voice.
"Is it you? I swore to protect you, remember? Adisla, is it you?"
"It is me,"
said the voice.
"Lady," he said.
And she came to him, hugging him and saying his name. Above them, the drumming stopped. Liai Bolmai turned to his brothers. His voice was weak, but he was resolute.
"We have unbound him now, and the spirit will find him. In hunger, the wolf will out, and he will do what he needs to do to welcome the god."
Now the animal cries and howling struck up again, but in a higher key. Adisla held Felix to her in the darkness.
"Are you going to kill me?"
"I am going to die for you," said Felix, unpicking the bonds around his ankles.
Above, Liai Bolmai sat down and took out his drum. It was 2 months into the final stage of his wolf-summoning chant, and the sorcerer was sweating heavily. His magic had been growing stronger by the day since he had battled Yabmeyaka, goddess of the underworld, but still he had not been sure the wolf would come. It had taken years to frame the magic correctly to call him, years of toil. Then he had torn something from the goddess, a bright gleaming rune that seemed supple and to grow like a tree. He had thought on the rune in his chanting, and had felt the wolf move towards him. Then, just 2 weeks ago, something had changed, and he had lost the creature, or so he thought. But now he had arrived, and he was just as he had seen him that first day in the mire. His face was exactly as he had seen it in his vision. The sorcerer could begin the transformation now. It would be the work of another month, maybe more, to get to where they needed to be, but Liai Bolmai was willing to wait. He had sent instructions to his whole nation, called every man of knowledge from wherever he hunted whales or stalked the reindeer, and now he was to reap his reward. He knew that many of the Noaides were weak and would not last the course of the magic, that some had untold miles to cross to be there, but he was content. Some would fall away, but others would take their places. He and those who began would be able to rest and rejoin the ritual as they saw fit. He felt physically drained, but ready. The battle with the goddess had strengthened him magically. He had ripped her knowledge from her, seen her accomplices die, and forced her to hand over their secrets, the screaming runes that he had torn from the grasp of the dead sisters. But the battle had unbalanced him, too. The runes buzzed within him, denying him sleep, filling him with odd energies and unwelcome sensations. Liai Bolmai was a gentle man, but not strong enough for those terrible symbols. He felt constantly sick, unsettled, and not a little mad. He thought of a rune like a spear, long and pointed. He concentrated on that. It would give him purpose. It did, though an unaccustomed anger rose up in him too. The runes were unmanageable and vastly dangerous, some raging like torrents of images and sounds that threatened to sweep away his sanity, others with a calm presence, disguising deep undertows into madness. The chanting went on, and the nights lengthened. Magnificent smears of colour appeared in the sky, the foxfire that meant the celestial fox spirit had been called to their gathering. Liai Bolmai knew the omens could not have been better. The fox was the most magical of creatures, and had blessed their ceremony by beating his tail until sparks flew across the heavens in shades of glowing green. He concentrated on the image he had seen of the dark goddess's lair in his mind, that terrible cliff. He needed to implant that into the mind of the wolf, so that it knew where to go when it emerged transformed from the cave. For 2 weeks the chanting never ceased. Felix and Adisla lost all sense of time in the darkness. There was only the food in the pack, and just the tiny stream of water to drink. Adisla, less used than Felix to physical hardship, began to fade. Felix, though his body remained strong, was losing his grip on reality under the relentless chanting. He sweated and coughed as the image of the troll wall came into his mind. It was not strange to him as it was to the sorcerers. He had hunted in that area many times, walked the land at the foot of the mountain, and looked up at it in awe.
Act, and then you will leave this trap. Set out for your destiny, he heard a voice say in his head. Kill and be free.
He felt compelled to do something, to step closer to something, but he couldn't see what it was, and the feeling made him miserable and uncomfortable. He was like a slave who finds his master screaming instructions at him in an incomprehensible language, wanting to act but not knowing what to do. Adisla felt him trembling. She was weak and terribly hungry. Outside, up on the surface, in the hollow light of an arctic dawn, Liai Bolmai felt beyond tiredness, unnaturally awake. He had broken from the ritual to eat a little, to rest his voice, and to try to sleep for the first time in days. He almost didn't hear the chanting now. The runes were all around him, as if they had lives of their own, hanging in space, fizzing, snapping, hissing, sometimes even sounding with rich musical notes. They had helped him, though. He had achieved that higher level where he could feel the animal heart of the wolf in the pit and talk to him, direct him, show him where to go. He had contacted the wolf many times in long and difficult rituals, spoken to him over vast distances, and heard him answer as a beast. The man in the pit seemed just a man. And yet it was him, he knew. The runes had shown him his face. He took it for another confusion of the magic, another product of his self-induced insanity. A howl split the grey air. Liai Bolmai shivered, not recognizing what was strange about it, but feeling disquiet anyway. The other Noaides on the rock glanced at each other. They, too, thought it had sounded odd. The perspective was wrong, if sound can have a perspective. It sounded far away, hollow, but it was loud, too, as if near. No one thought of the simplest explanation. The creature was much bigger than any wolf they had ever heard before. In the cave, Felix sat up, feeling a cold dread. He knew better than anyone that the cry of the wolf was unnatural. Liai Bolmai had a terrible ache in his head, but still he smiled. The wolves of the plain were greeting the wolf god's arrival, he was sure. The howl from the mainland was repeated. It was very loud, thought the sorcerer, very loud indeed. Unease rippled through the Noaides, but excitement, too. The howling was just a side effect of the magic. Their defender was coming, they were sure. Down on the beach, a youth was getting out of a boat, calling to them. From his accent, Liai Bolmai recognized him as an eastern Noaidi, typically late for the ceremony. He was glad to have that thought. Pleased to be linked to a world of mundanity away from the dreadful presence of those runes.
"The wolf! The wolf is coming! The wolf is here!" the young man was shouting.
Liai Bolmai huddled into the fire. Did the boy really sense the wolf, or was he just trying to make up for in enthusiasm what he lacked in timeliness?
"Pick up your drum and join in, brother!"
a man next to Liai Bolmai called down, his voice hoarse from chanting.
"A black wolf with eyes of foxfire! He's there, out on the plain! He's there!"
"He is within," said Liai Bolmai.
A gust of air chilled his shoulder. He turned to look at the Noaidi next to him, surprised to see that, though momentarily the man was still standing, he didn't have a head. Chapter 41 Werewolf. Vali was lost, really lost. The drums no longer called to him. He could still hear them in his mind, but he felt no desire to follow them any more. The beat was more urgent. He understood its demands. It wanted him to step forward inside himself, to become what he could. He found it easy to ignore. He had killed some things, and that had helped him grow, he recalled. And when he had grown, the drums had lost their power. He was stepping forward all right, but under the impulse of his own magic, urgent and compelling as a tidal surge. As his body rippled with vigour, his mind contracted. He had difficulty following any chain of reasoning. Images of his life were there and gone again, like mountains under fleeting cloud. A yearning, an adolescent itch for action, was upon him, though he couldn't think what he wanted to do. He didn't sleep for days, and it seemed to him that he didn't quite fit in his skin. His heart would beat fast for no reason, and he feared he would die. Then a smirking calm would descend, and he would start to feel unaccountably pleased with himself. He looked at his body, and it seemed to him a very fine thing. His hands were strong and large, his muscles huge and pronounced, and his teeth felt like shining knives in his head. He was aware that he had forgotten a great deal. He couldn't remember how he had come to the cave. For a moment or two he would recall why it was important that he found out how he had come to lie naked underground, far away from anything he recognized. But then it would slip from his mind, and all curiosity about his condition would disappear. He had no difficulty, though, recalling the deep savour of the meat that moves and then is still, the prey that had surrendered its power to him, and it seemed that, as he digested the flesh of his victims, the memories, or rather the sentiments and attitudes of those he had consumed, were digested too. Vali spent a while playing with rocks on the floor of the cave, knocking one into another as if he was a child. He sat with endless patience, watching the snow fall, as a woman waiting for a hunter to return might. He pictured the man he had surprised in the valley, saw the shaking hands trying to knock an arrow to the bowstring. The memory of the archer's fear was delicious, recalled like the scent of baking bread. When Vali slept, his dreams were full of Adisla, but they were full of the wolf, too. It was bound, agonizingly bound, the fetters digging into its flesh, and that awful sword holding open its mouth. Vali had one of those strange feelings that only make sense in dreams and blink away with the morning light. He was dreaming about the wolf he knew, but it seemed to him that the wolf was dreaming about him, too, or rather was simply dreaming him. He felt he didn't exist outside of the god's mind, and the boundaries between himself and the wolf were insubstantial things, as nothing to their shared communion of pain. He felt its constriction as his own, a crushed, tied, pinioned sensation that would suddenly relent and snap into release and contentment. When he awoke, his limbs were longer and his teeth bigger. He didn't know how long he lay in that cave, weeks or months, but it was cold when clarity finally came to him, in that moment between hunger and satiety. It was as if, his appetites in balance, his mind was free to think. He went outside and looked around. Snow was falling, the sky was heavy and the light was flat. It was dusk, the air was full of scents. Over the hills behind him a bear was moving, late to its hibernation he could tell, and down on the plain people were gathering. In the far distance was the sea, purple and blue, and in the sea an island. Men were going to it, he could smell them moving across the plain. Their odours of sweat and grime were powerful and alluring. Reindeer were with them, one or more geldings, their piss and shit unpungent. Voices came through the still air. He listened. There were three distant heartbeats, one animal, two human. Now he could see them, a man and a youth driving a reindeer pulling a sled, to which was attached a pack of provisions and a shallow drum. He saw them look up at the cave, but they didn't spot him. They were clearly thinking of resting there for the night as the snow became heavier. They were debating something, one pointing on down the trail, the other up into the cave. Barley could see that the two were hurrying to something, and wondering if they could make it by nightfall in the worsening weather. The man held out his hand and let the snow fall on it. Then he shook his head, and the travellers began to make their way up the slope. Barley shrank away inside the cave, right to the back. Saliva rose to his mouth, and his limbs felt looser. The men were at the mouth of the cave now. A stone came whistling in, then another. They were checking for wild animals. He heard them speak to each other. When he peered out from his hiding place in the shadows, he saw them examining something on the floor. The man rubbed it in his fingers and looked at the youth. Then he shrugged and stood. Barley saw he had a spear. The man stared hard into the cave, picked up another stone and threw it past Barley. There was a roar. Barley felt his heart racing, his muscles clenching, his head dizzy. The youth leapt back with a shout, but the man was laughing. He had pretended to be a bear. The joke seemed to calm them both, and they set about building a fire and bringing the reindeer up. The creature wouldn't come inside, and eventually the youth gave up and left it tied at the cave mouth. The smell of the fire comforted Barley and penetrated into his mind far more deeply than any aroma he had ever known. The smoke seemed unlike any other smoke he had ever smelled, and he could tell the tree that had been used for the fire had been a strong one, fed from an underground stream, not felled for its wood, just a few branches taken. Barley thought of Adisla. Her presence in his mind was now all that kept him from giving in to the beast inside him. If he could find her, he might feel better. Something had happened to him, he could tell, a sort of illness. Barley did not want a cure, though. Didn't want to go back to what he had been. He just wanted to feel right, not to have this terrible sensation of dislocation and restraint bearing down on him. It was love like a hunger, sharp and selfish. The men cooked, but their own odours were far more appealing to Barley. The sweat, the saliva, the secretions of the glands of their hair and skin all seemed sizzling little calls to murder. Then a sudden wave of repugnance took him, and his thoughts nauseated him. The travellers were tired, and the fire was warm. They both fell asleep where they sat, still in their furs. Silently, Barley came forward. He was surprised to see how small they were. Light on snow removes all perspective, and it had been impossible to tell their size from a distance. These men were dwarfs, people who had seemingly walked out of a story. The man standing up would hardly have come up to Barley's waist. The boy was even smaller. The reindeer began to fret. It was tiny, too, full-grown with wide antlers, and old, but much smaller than he had ever seen a mature stag before. And the cave mouth had shrunk. When Barley had come in, it was too high to touch. Now he almost had to stoop to stand up in it. Some strange shrinking magic was happening, he was sure. Barley sat down by their fire and warmed himself. Thoughts brawled in his mind. He thought of Disa, of the fire at her home, of winter evenings with Adisla by his side. He thought of blood, the smack and savour of the kill. He thought of Bragi taking his arm on the longship, telling him everything was going to be all right. He thought of the ruin of his rage, the bloody dead. He watched the sleeping men and had the urge to kill them. Something was stopping him, though. It was as if the ghost of himself was haunting what he had become, drawing him back from the inevitable. The fire was warm and fragrant, and he lay down. He slept and dreamed he was himself, a man who loved a woman, and thought that was enough. There was a shout. It was light. One of the tiny men was yelling, and the other had a spear. Their movements seemed very slow and cumbersome to Vali. The man threw the spear. Vali just stepped around it. The smell of their dread swept over him, urging him on to attack. But he fought the impulse. The dream of the person he had been was in his mind. He could still be that man. He tried to speak, to tell them they had no need to be afraid. But when he did, he was shocked. A low rumble filled the cave, like thunder in the hills. He was growling, he realized. The youth was on his hands and knees, trying to scramble past Vali. The man had picked up a stone and was hurling it at him.
"Kill 100 of them for me!"
The words were harsh, but an echo of what Adisla had meant came back to him.
"Return! Be with me again!"
The memory suffocated his anger, and he was paralyzed. The boy had got past him and was screaming to the man to do the same. He did, diving under Vali to where the reindeer was going wild. The men released the panicking animal and just ran for it, almost falling down the slope in their haste. Vali went to the cave mouth, sat breathing heavily, and watched them flapping over the plain towards the shore. The snow had stopped, but it was still difficult to see any distance. Vali felt shaken. He had had the overwhelming urge to kill them, but he had fought it, fought whatever disease or enchantment was on his mind, and he had won. There was a way back to Adisla. The men ran for a while and then stopped. They looked back at him and saw that he hadn't pursued them. They stood talking, and presently Vali could see they were having an argument, sense their stress on the breeze. Then one walked off towards the sea and that distant island, while the other called and caught the reindeer. He took something like a broad dish from a pack on its back, let the animal go, and began to walk back towards Vali. Vali felt nothing as he watched him come, no more than he did when he looked at the sky or the sea. The man approached slowly. He was beating a drum. The rhythm was different to the one Vali had heard that had led him to this place, the one that had vanished as he came to the cave. It was slower and more deliberate, and backed with a forceful chant. Vali smelled fear, but also excitement. The man came closer, stopping eventually at the foot of the scree slope that led up to the cave mouth. Here he stood fixing Vali with a stare, banging the drum and making gestures towards him. It all meant nothing to Vali, who was lost in himself, holding the door to the slaughterhouse of his thoughts hard shut. He knew what he wanted to do. Eat this fool in front of him, and then chase down his companion and do the same to him. But he wouldn't. Why not? He had forgotten the reason. He just knew it was important to restrain himself. Vali could hear the drummer's heartbeat, sense the blood flowing through the cavities of his body, almost taste his presence on the air. The man's breath was hot with excitement, his skin basted with fear. He brought the drumming to a climax, hammering out a frenzy of blows on the skin, gave a heavy last strike, and threw his drumstick onto the ground in front of Vali, his eyes wide with challenge and expectation. Then his expression changed. His spell had not worked. Vali, now more wolf than wolf man, tore out his heart. Chapter 42. Success for the Sorcerer. panic swept the rock. The resting Naiades tried to help those still lost to the power of the drums and chanting. Some woke easily, others not at all, and had to be left to death as their brothers sought what little protection the Bear Island provided. Liai Bolmai found himself flat on his face, concealed in the dark of the cave entrance, digging in his furs for his little knife. There was a squelching noise like a man walking through a swamp, and he saw the monster put its back paws through the chest of the Naiade in the bird mask. The gigantic creature was hideous. Its black wolf's head, with eyes of shining emerald, sat on a body that was a twisted standoff between man and wolf, though three times the size of the biggest man Liai Bolmai had ever seen. The creature loped on all fours, its back limbs and front left, those of a wolf, while its front right, which it used to tear and smash the Noaides, to pull them into its crushing jaws, was the arm of a freakishly big human. The sorcerers had been taken completely by surprise. Some were slashing at the creature with their knives, some were throwing rocks, a few were shooting arrows from squat bows, but most were scrambling for the boats that would take them off the island. Liai Bolmai cleared his mind. Hadn't he bound the wolf? He had gone to it in its dreams, called it with his drums, commanded it into the cave, and done all the magic as the runes had revealed. He had also heard the girl with the wolf, and it was certain they were known and important to each other. And hadn't the wolf appeared in exactly the form he had seen in his visions? So what was this thing? He felt himself pissing where he lay. He had to control himself, to think clearly. Then he understood that he had been deceived. Somehow the goddess had tricked him. He had snared a wolf, but not the one he was looking for. And yet he had touched its mind, run with it in the wide dark of the mountains, breathed its joy in the kill. He could not understand it. Liai Bolmai was an honest man. He had no delight in the dark magics he had been shown, and looked for power only to defend himself rather than for its own sake. He knew what he had to do, to give the girl he had uprooted and the wolfman he had enchanted and damned a chance. He went further into the cave and threw down the ropes.
"The wolf is here," he said into the darkness. "Stay until it has finished killing. I will do my best to control it. I will."
He never finished his sentence. A primordial sense told him that something was behind him, something worse than a neck-break fall. He stepped forward into the darkness. At the bottom of the shaft, Felix and Adisla heard Liai Bolmai crash to the ground beside them, and then his scream. He had torn his arm from its socket, and couldn't stifle his agony. Then something else dropped softly down the shaft. Some sort of creature. In the blackness, there were retching and coughing noises. The creature hacked, growled, and snapped again and again. She heard it snuffle forward, its snout testing the darkness. Adisla was close to collapse. She could concentrate on nothing, think of nothing but the awful scraping sounds coming from the creature's throat, within which she seemed to hear some words.
"My love," it said, "I have found you."
Chapter 43. A Sacrifice.
Vali. That name still described what faced Adisla in the black of the pit. How much change must you go through before you are no longer you? How many planks can you replace on a ship before you have to say that you have a new boat?
Vali's jaws dripped with the blood of the sorcerers. His mind was full of the scent of their panic, and yet, now that he had found Adisla, a glimpse of who he was came to him, indistinctly,
hardly discernible, as a distant shore might appear through haze. This was the girl he had loved since the instant he met her. He fought down his other perceptions, the delicious aroma of anxiety that clung to her, the succulence of her flesh, even her threat. She was not him, and every living thing that was not him now seemed hostile and dangerous.
No, said Adisla. No!
She could see nothing in the darkness, nothing at all, but that made the creature more terrible. Its rasping voice, the heat of its breath.
I have found you, as I vowed, said Vali. Come from this place.
Adisla shied back, reaching for Felix's hand.
What are you? She said.
Your love, Vali.
The Noaidi was trying to bite back his pain, but his suffering escaped him in suppressed groans. Vali felt the attraction of the holy man's agony, calling him to feed. His skin felt alive, his muscles drawing power from his questing hunger.
Keep away from me, said Adisla.
Her body convulsed as she clung to Felix in the dark. Vali could see them clearly and felt his lips draw back from his teeth, his legs prepare to spring. He willed himself to be still. Felix spoke.
It is him. I saw the beginning of this change. It is the prince.
Adisla was shaking her head.
Let me take you from here, said the wolf.
Adisla drew in her breath and backed further away.
I will not go.
Better that than the damp and dark, said Felix. Go. If it is your turn to die, then you will die.
I do not fear death. Only him.
He is as the Norns wish him to be. Now go.
Still she did not go. Felix pushed her forward. Then fear killed all her thoughts, and she did not resist as Vali gathered her up. Her weight was nothing to him, and he lifted her to the top of the shaft and then pulled himself up using his human arm. Three Noaidi stood at the mouth of the cave. The sun had risen behind them, turning the rocks inside to burning gold and revealing Vali and his burden to the sorcerers. They let fly with their bows. Vali turned his back to them to shield Adisla. The arrows hit him hard, but didn't even break his skin. Vali put the girl down, turned again, and made a stuttering, snarling run towards them. They fell back and scattered. Vali returned to Adisla. She tried to summon her strength, not for herself, but for him.
Do you remember what you were?
I remember the betony you gave me when I first went out to fight. I remember you at the river, the sun on the water, and you racing your brothers from bank to bank. I remember how you kissed me when we last saw each other. I remember you, Adisla. So I remember me.
Adisla looked at him. Somewhere in his expression, in the inclination of his head, she could see her Vali. It was him. So how could she be afraid?
Do you know what you have become? Said Adisla.
The creature bowed its head. It stammered,
I am a better thing.
No, Vali, you are not. You must come back to me, said Adisla. We must break this curse.
Felix was beside her. He had climbed one of the ropes Liai Bolma had thrown down the shaft. The wolf spoke.
It feels like a blessing. I am so strong, and the world is so beautiful.
We have had only one blessing in life, and one curse, said Adisla. Each other. You have found me, and I will find you. There are sorcerers who will help you, and we will take them the gifts they ask to save you."
Tuvali, at Isla's body, sparkled with scents, sang with her fear, and there was another sensation too, something even more persuasive. They would be together forever if he ate her. They would be the same person. What closer love than that is possible? No! Her connection to him was stronger than hunger. Her love burst over him like cool water on hot iron, and made a blade of his will.
"What would you have me do, Adisla?"
"Wait here, on this island."
"I cannot command myself."
"Then let us command you. Vali, this is a trap and a refuge. Go within, and let us keep you here. We will bring your salvation, I promise."
"I will starve."
"Your hunger is worse fulfilled. It will be a noble agony, and, I promise, my love, it will end."
The great beast craned its head in something like thought. Vali saw the flight of the arrow, and knew it was going to miss him, so he ignored it. He hadn't thought where else it might go. It struck Adisla in the leg, spinning her to the ground in a hard fall. The bowman died for her, killed not for his arrow, but so that Vali's hunger could feast on flesh that was not Adisla's. She was trying to stand, her stricken movements firing all his wolf senses, impelling him to take her. He leapt towards her and stood above her, the man he had been struggling to spare her, the wolf he had almost become, simmering in resentment at that restraint. No, yes, no, yes, yes. The wolfman shoved at Vali's side, punching and slapping at him, trying to shake his attention from the stricken girl. Slowly the wolf turned its head to him, the black bulk of its body almost featureless against the light of the cave mouth. Felek was shouting at Vali, trying to get through to him.
"After her! There is no way back! After her! This, always!"
Blood filled up Vali's senses. He seemed almost to teeter above Adisla, rocking and keening as he struggled to fight the pull of her distress. There was a scream from below. Liai Bolmai had tried to climb from the shaft, but the ruin of his arm made it impossible, and he had fallen. The wolf lunged at Adisla. She felt his breath on her face, his teeth brush her neck. But Vali, still there inside the wolf, pulled his animal body back, slammed Felek to one side, and threw himself into the shaft after the sorcerer. He tumbled down, crashing to the floor.
"I am lost," said Vali, not in the wolf's growl, but in the voice of his mind. "And I will never be found again."
Liai Bolmai scrambled back through the darkness, back away from the thing he had summoned. He knew he had lost the goddess, and his duty was clear.
"Seal us in!" he shouted. "Seal us in!"
At the top of the shaft, Felek was heaving at the flat boulder. He couldn't budge it. Adisla stood, stumbled, stood again, and added her weight. A Noaidi ran in to join them. They rolled the stone down the wall until it was level with the shaft. Adisla fell to her hands and knees at the edge of the pit. She looked down to see a pair of green eyes reflecting the light of the rising sun. The rumbling voice echoed up the shaft.
"Forget me," it said,
and Felek dropped the boulder over the hole. Chapter 44 For Love. No drumming. No chanting. The remaining Noaides were numb, slumped on the bare rock as if still entranced. Already the birds were descending, ravens and crows dropping from the sky,
their cracked cries sounding something like delight. Noaides helped Feleg pile more stones over the boulder to ensure that the beast could not escape. Adisla watched helpless, her leg now agony after the initial shock had subsided. When a Noaide approached her, Feleg snarled at the man, but he had a small bag and made a sign for the wolfman to be calm. Feleg allowed him to draw the arrow and dress the wound. Adisla was beyond screaming as the arrow was withdrawn, and sat vacantly on the rock. The Noaide pushed water to her lips, gave her reindeer meat and flatbread, while Feleg returned to pile on more stones. Feleg could hear the screams from the shaft. He wondered how long the creature's resolve to stay in the pit would last. It had food in the shape of the sorcerer. Would that feed its growth? Would it become strong enough to get out? Never mind. They would be long gone by then. When they could get no more stones on the pile, Feleg rejoined Adisla and put his arms around her. She returned his embrace, but not as warmly as he wanted. She was grateful to him, and pleased they were both alive, but she did not love him. He had heard what she had said to Vali, and knew she was prepared to die for her prince. Despite herself, tears came into Adisla's eyes. Feleg stroked her hair. He had vowed to kill Vali because the prince had captured him and taken him from a wolf's life. But for that moment in the cave, knowing what it was to love someone and to feel that love in his arms, Feleg should have regarded him as his savior.
"We will free him."
"How?"
"I told you. I have many treasures in the hills. And I spoke the truth. I will present them to the witches, put myself at their mercy, and ask them to save your prince."
"And then?"
"I am a wolf," he said, "and have had enough of tomorrow and yesterday. I will die, or I will not. I will go to the hills, or I will not. I will exist, or I will not."
She thought of Vali looking up at her from the pit. She had seen something of the man in those strange green eyes. She loved and admired him more than ever when she thought of his courage. He had allowed them to seal him in. He, unlike her, had the bravery to die. But then she looked at Feleg, so like him in appearance, so different in personality. In some ways, it was as if the gods had answered her prayers, given her a low-born man in Vali's image, someone she could marry, perhaps could love.
"I will follow you," said Adisla. "There is no need. The witches are not always merciful."
"More merciful than the fates," said Adisla.
She looked at him and squeezed his hand.
"There will be great danger," he said.
"Feleg, I'll follow you, because you came here for me and you saved me. I see that you are the first among men. I'll follow you because I want my Vali back, but I'll follow you for baser reasons, too. I have no home to go to. My mother is dead in the most awful way, and I can never look on that place again without that memory. If I cannot be with him, I'll be with you. And if I cannot be with you, then my life is over."
Feleg now knew that he would have what he so desperately wanted, if only the prince died in that hole. All he had to do was fetch bigger and bigger rocks, perhaps even persuade the Noaides to bring some over by boat, and make sure that thing was sealed in until it starved. Adisla had tears on her face as her eyes turned to the great heap of stones over the shaft.
"Come on," said Feleg. "We will go to the witches."
Chapter 45. Buried Treasure. Veles Libor was not in a good mood. His promise to King Hemming that he would find a way to rid him of the prince and make him a little money at the same time had come to nothing. The deception of the escape, played for the benefit of the mob, had been a good one, but he hadn't foreseen the pirate attack. Hemming would fall into a fury if Velis returned without Forkbeard's gold, and would assume he had pocketed it himself. That, thought Velis, would be a problem to dwarf the unenviable difficulties he was already facing. He couldn't believe how quickly they had lost Valley in the fog. They'd scarcely cut him adrift when he disappeared, and there had been no sign at all of him since.
"I'd just cut loose from this king if I were you," said Bodvar Bjarki. "You could disappear east, and he'd never hear of you again."
"Neither would anyone else. A merchant without a prince to protect him is nothing," said Velis. "And besides, his name is worth 10 on every 100 to me."
The berserk was ungovernable, he thought. The crew would have been mutinous if they had not been so depleted and weakened by the attack, and the ship was low on provisions. His actions during the battle had made him an object of contempt to the men, and he had to endure being called Barrel Man, Keg Creeper, Tun Tickler, and whatever other less than inventive nicknames they could come up with. Despite this, Velis now assumed informal command of the vessel, in that he determined its next move. This was not because he had any authority with Bjarki or the hired crew, but because he was the only one who seemed to have any idea what they might do. They stopped at the little market at Kaupangen, where he managed to sell some of the taken battle gear for a reasonable price, and to hire 5 passably hardy-looking Danes to replace some of the men lost in the battle. He made sure the Danes knew who paid their wages and picked them for their brawn and stupidity. He wanted stupid. It was an essential requirement for the expedition he had in mind. He had lies to tell and didn't want clever men finding them out. The crew was down to 26, 5 for him, at least in theory, and 19 for the berserk. The odds were very far from ideal, but they were better than they had been. Luckily for Velis, the berserk wanted Vali as much as he did. Bjarki had vowed to take the prince to Forkbeard, and that was an unnegotiable promise, so for the moment he found Velis useful. Bjarki was a brute, but not a fool, and he knew the merchant's brains would be useful in the hunt. After that, well, who knew who had been killed in the pirate attack? Velis looked at the berserk. He was no mind-reader, but could guess what Bjarki was thinking. The merchant needed to make himself indispensable to him. When Velis settled to thinking about a problem, then, if there was an answer, he usually found it. At Heithebir, he had heard whispers that Harik was using Vali's farm girl to ransom his son. He had not told Vali this, because he had very quickly seen that the prince wasn't in a position to pay for the information, nor to offer any other sort of benefit. However, now he saw a happy meeting of needs between himself and Bodvar Bjarki. The girl had gone north. Harik had gone north. The prevailing current would take Vali north if he wasn't shipwrecked on the way. Velis would take his ship up the Northland coast, find whale people, and ask for information about the girl, Harik, and the prince. Find either of the first two, and he would find the third, he thought. There was another reason to go north. He had heard of an island where the whale people made sacrifices to their stupid gods. There was a rumour of gold there. Bjarki was convinced it was defended by sorcery, but Velis thought otherwise. In truth, Velis had very little respect for magic or for any god. He had seen his children playing by the fire with the whale people's holy objects, hung embroideries of the Christ god on his walls for decoration, heard people all over the world singing the praises of Wotan, Odin, Redi, Svarog, Spentamainu, Jesus, and other gods. All seemed the same to him. Pictures and carvings, beautiful, but empty. He put more faith in himself the swords of Heming, and the power of coin than he did in the supernatural. The sorcerer who had made his child's mask hadn't been protected by his magic from whoever took it from him. Jesus had been taken